Recording. Here we go. On in. Well, thanks, Bryce. I think Bryce's prayer really hits it well as we study these things that were given to us and to those in the past for God's glory. And it's interesting as we look at so much of this that we're going to be looking at God's predictive power, his ability to foretell things, to cast light on the current events of that time. And it's interesting that really from both perspectives, from their perspective, before things happened, it was an encouragement and it gave them hope. And our perspective now, after the fact, it gives us hope for the future too. And so looking at so many of these things, we can draw a lot of encouragement. All right, we are going to be kind of starting off kind of this little second section here, the consolation of the Gentiles. So we previously gave kind of a consolation to the Jews that were in captivity, and God was giving comfort to them and letting them know that he was sovereign, that he reigns throughout all world history, not just over Israel, but that all the nations of the world, right? And he's letting them know he's going to rescue them from slavery, right? He's going to bring justice to those who enslave them, you know? And then as we look to the Gentiles, what is their end, right? Ultimately, though, when we look at it, God will continue to expose their false gods. He'll expose the nothingness of idols and those who make them, but he's also going to give them reason for hope. And so, and that's a great thing because as I look around, I'm in a room full of Gentiles, right? And so that hope extended to us today, and that's an interesting perspective for us that when we see this hope given to the Gentiles and to the whole world, we're reaping that harvest right now. All right, so as we begin, we're going to finish up chapter 41, and then we're going to jump into chapter 42, which I don't want to just skip through this, but chapter 42, obviously, probably something that we're more familiar with. But what we see here initially is the verdict. So we start off in Isaiah 41, 25 through 26. I have aroused one from the north, and he has come from the rising of the sun. He will call on my name. And he will come upon rulers as upon mortar, even as the potter treads clay. Who has declared this from the beginning that we might know, or from the former times that we might say, he is right? Surely there is no one who declared, surely there is no one who proclaimed, surely there is no one who heard your words. All right, Cyrus is being referenced here. We've talked about Cyrus, right? From the north, from the rising of the sun in the east. And ultimately, he's kind of saying here, his actions, you know, he will call on my name, right? And so that's an interesting prediction to give of this ruler of this great Gentile nation, that he will call on the name of the Lord. And yet, we go to Ezra 1 and verse 2. Ezra 1 and verse 2, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, right? And we see that through Cyrus, right? He did the Lord's will in many ways. And so ultimately he gave God the credit. And not to necessarily say that he was a man of faith or was a faithful man to God. God used him for his purposes, but he recognized that and had at least the soundness of mind and the humility to give God glory for that. And that's a really interesting prediction that God could predict that a man named Cyrus from this foreign kingdom that would be this great man over the Persian Empire would do such a thing. And again, as we go to that in verse 26, when he says, who has declared, right, at former times that he might say, he is right. Surely there's no one declared. There's no one, surely no one who heard your words. Sorry, there's multiple parts in these slides. And so you just, again, the idols are silent. The idols can't predict. And so as we kind of, this case against the idols, this verdict being given of their falseness, as that continues to happen, God is showing himself and why he is so much greater, why he is the only God, right? Greater is not really a word because he's pointing out that the idols are nothing. All right. Formerly in verse 27, I said to Zion, behold, here they are. And to Jerusalem, I give a messenger of good news. But when I look, there is no one. There is no counselor among them who, if I ask, can give answer. Behold, all of them are false. Their works are worthless. Their molten images are wind and emptiness. So Zion will be the one delivered, and Cyrus would be the one giving this good news that the Jews could return home. And so, you know, when he's saying to Jerusalem, he's going to give this messenger of Cyrus. It's going to be the one that delivers this good news. And that's, again, an interesting messenger for God to choose. Isaiah is telling them that Cyrus is going to do this, but ultimately God is in control. And as we look at 28 and 29, we kind of see this court case is finished a second time, right? We've seen this case that's being made against these false things, and he's exposing the shallowness of idols and the shallowness of those who would rely on them for help, because the idols can give no help. The Gentile world is without a voice of revelation of what is to come with its false religion. And ultimately, these molten images, they are of creation. They are a created thing of creation. And so they have no ability to see the future. They have no ability to know what will come next in creation, because they didn't take any part in that. And God is making a case and exposing that. Any comments on chapter 41 before we move in to 42? All right. Moving into chapter... Go ahead.
I'm just going to point out one thing there in verse 27. I will give to Jerusalem the herald of good news. Of course, we know that, you know, in the first century, the good news originated, you know, from Jerusalem, mm-hmm. out from Jerusalem to the whole world. And so yeah. there's an aspect of this that's even beyond the Old Testament times.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, yeah, this good news, you know, to the Jews, it would have been this returning home. But again, the good news, the gospel is something. And this servant that we're about to talk about is going to be the herald of that good news. Yeah, great. Great point. All right. So as we move into 42, this is the first servant song. And so, you know, when someone asks you to teach Isaiah, you're kind of like, oh man, that's a big order. But when they hand you the first servant song, you're like, I got this. This is good stuff. So this is kind of that, like, bread and butter of Isaiah, getting into the servant songs. But Isaiah 42 is the first servant song. And I'm going to focus more on this, and I'm sure Ryan will probably give, like, more breakdown statistics of all the servant songs and compare them all. And honestly, that would be, like, a great class or a quarter in and of itself, just looking at those. Isaiah 53 tends to be the most well-known servant song. So when we think of the servant songs, right, when we have our Lord's Supper led, oftentimes Isaiah 53, right, is where we go, just because the imagery and because of the familiarness there. And yet, it's not necessarily to overshadow 42. The servant songs, they sort of like build as a crescendo in a lot of ways. And so I think maybe that is part of the reason as well. But I think as we become more familiar with these, as I look to them, I appreciate the other ones even more. And so, again, they all have this great beauty and imagery and poetic nature and power. These songs foretell Jesus, right? We can see that. And for us, really, they further reveal him to us. And so it's interesting that, you know, we have the Gospels that reveal Jesus to us. And yet, looking at these servant songs, we still learn more about him, right? And when we see what this servant was meant to become and what he did become, it helps us appreciate more the power that was revealed. And there is so much that we can grab. And so these are important parts of Revelation to us as well. And it's interesting, as we look at the servant songs, we are really looking at the servant, okay? So the servant songs, you know, in some ways, they are written to all of us as servants, right? But they are about the servant. They're about Jesus. And so we see, you know, so many layers to the Bible, and there's so many layers here that as some of this stuff read, we see ourselves in it, but we see it because we seek to be like the servant. And so it's interesting how that goes. Jesus explains this if we look in Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20, starting in verse 26. This is him talking to his servants. And he said, "It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. And so when we look at Jesus explaining what it means to be a servant in his kingdom, right, what it means to be great, right, to be high, you must be low. You know, when he says, let him be your servant, he's also showing that it's a choice, right? Let him choose to be your servant, okay? If you want to be great, then this is the choice you need to make, is to serve. And he says, let him be a slave, right? It's showing the depth of that service, right? This is not just a servant role, but a slave, right? In complete submission to this master and to others. And when he says he came not to serve, but to serve, we see this true heart, right? And that's the core of Jesus. Everything he did on earth, he came to serve. He lowered himself from such great heights that we can't even see to such humble circumstances, right? The fall for us is far less, far less. And that's what he wants. And ultimately, Jesus gave his life as a ransom for many. The servant made that ultimate thing, a price that we can't pay, right? We don't have a perfect life to give, but he did, and he gave it willingly as a servant of his Father. Jesus isn't only a servant, he's the servant, prophesied, foretold by the only God with the power to do such things. And again, that is standing in great opposition to these idols, right? This 41 to 42, there's a delineation there, there's a separation of thought. The chapter was added by us, right? And so really, this is a continuation in many ways of this thought, right? He's ending this kind of case against the idols, and he's going to show this contrast with his servant. But the two are closely linked. And for those that would have been listening, it would have been obvious, the comparison and the contrast that he was making there. So we start out in verse 42. Behold, my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights, I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. Behold, it really is kind of, who is he beholden to? He's kind of announcing this to those false idols, to those that would do that, kind of in continuing that thought, right? Whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. Is there any imagery that, like, you're thinking of from the New Testament that kind of represents this verse? You're having to read Ryan's mind through my words, so it's tricky. But it would be the baptism of Jesus, right? When the Spirit of God descended upon him and he said, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, right? That's not the only time that we could reference this verse, but I think it's kind of this clear imagery of the Spirit of God falling upon his servant in whom he was well pleased, right? And so when we see that, servant, you know, here can refer to, you know, sometimes we see this referring to Israel, and sometimes we see it kind of referring to the individual Messiah. And the great thing about Jesus, through his perfect obedience, we really see the ideal of both, right? Jesus is the ideal of what Israel should have been. And Jesus is also the ideal of the Messiah and kind of that individual perfect servant. And so he stands as this ideal example for all of us in so many different ways, for them and for us, and through him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. God upholds and delights in his servant and put his spirit upon him. And it's interesting, that idea of God the Father upholding his servant, right? It's the servant-master relationship, right? That relationship exists, and in a servant-master relationship, especially a perfect one, there are certain assumptions that are going to be made. Right? The servant is going to do the work of his master. He's going to be obedient to his master's will, right? And the servant also gets very little credit, right? It's not about the credit, right? Who does the servant try to make look good? The master, right? And everything that Jesus did, when we know, was in subjection to the Father and was according to his Father's will. It wasn't about his own glory. It was about the glory of the Father. And in the same way, you know, what is the role of the master in that relationship? Right? He's serving. The master protects. The master upholds. Right? The master delights in and gives praise to a servant that's done a job well done. And we see that in Jesus the Son and God the Father relationship, right? Those are the roles in that. Not to say you know, there's a, you know, true Father, Son, and created Creator relationship there, right? Those are the roles that they played. And when we look at us, the imbalance, again, is even greater, but that master-servant relationship still exists. And there is that same upholding. There is that same goal there for the Father to delight in us as we serve. And so we give servants in obedience as a servant to our Master upholds and delights and gives of his Spirit to us. He who believes and is baptized will receive the gifts of the Holy Spirit, right? And that's the Spirit falling upon us, right? Doesn't come down like a dove, but it does rest upon us, and those gifts are given to us. And so really what we're going to see in the theme in this first servant song is justice, perseverance, and reliability. Okay, and those are things given to us by a Master. Having found no justice in Jerusalem, right? One thing we see that's great about Jesus is his servant will bring justice with him, right? I have put my Spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations, right? It's not Jerusalem that's doing that. It's not Israel. It is the servant that is going to bring forth justice to the nations, right? He carries that with him. And we see just that powerful imagery. And again, all these things stand in contrast to the idols that did nothing, right? And this is at a time, too, when, you know, in that time period, Israel wasn't great, right? These things that are being spoken of about Israel, you would, if you read them and you were someone with no faith, you would be going, Israel? And, you know, like, what do they have? They're not one of the greatest of the nations. Their gods are weak, right? But the answer to that will come. Any thoughts? All right, we'll keep moving, and we'll see how we do on time. 32 and verse 2, he will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard from the street. Right now, this, we do instantly think probably of the more famous servant song in 53 and verse 7. That imagery there, as he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep that is before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth, right? This servant is not a conqueror coming in and forcing religion upon his conquered people, right? That's not how God converts, right? Jesus reveals himself calmly, right? He came about speaking to the lowly. He came about seeking those who were in need, who saw their need, that came to him, right? He didn't go about seeking to impress the powerful. He didn't raise up an army, even though, interestingly enough, the Jews knew this was about the Messiah, and yet they still expected so many of those things. When God clearly is telling them, that's not who I'm going to be. That's not who my servant is. That's not how he's going to do it. Now, we do have the benefit of hindsight, so give them some mercy in that. And those with true hearts for this servant understood it once it was spoken to them. God is always at work, and he guides the sun, he guides all things within creation, right? He guides the nations around him, and yet he does it in such a way that his handiwork is often unseen, that people could look around and say there is no God, right? Why is that the case, right? Because his servants don't sign their work, right? It's not about the name, it's about glorifying the Master who is in heaven. A bruised reed he will not break. A dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. Right? It reads like one of the Psalms. Right? This idea that a reed that is bruised, that is bent, you know, I mean, just the structure of a reed, once that break, once there is kind of a tear or a weakness in kind of that hollow wood, there's no fixing it at that point. Right? It's broken. It's structurally gone, and it's just waiting for a gust of wind to completely break that in half. And yet, he's going to nurse that back to strength, right? Or this idea of a candle wick that's at its end, and it's just barely smoldering and smoking, and it's just waiting to die. And yet, he's going to faithfully bring forth justice, right? He is going to nurse the weak back to strength. And so we see that that he is going, it's on the verge of going out, and yet he doesn't get up. We see his gentle nature nursing the weak back to strength while bringing justice to those who hurt them. Right? And that's a promise to the people then, right, that are in captivity, that were struggling, those that even had faith, but it was weak, right? It was damaged. They were looking for hope. And this servant, and this promise of this servant was giving it to them. Yet he will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice on the earth, and the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law, right? So in contrast to those that are weak, that are almost burnt out, he's not going to be disheartened or crushed, right? Now that is implying something there, right? He's not going to be disheartened or crushed in spite of great tragedy that would dishearten and crush other men, right? And so we're seeing kind of this prediction again of a hard life, right? We're seeing this prediction of trials and tribulations of such a nature that he will not be disheartened or crushed, right? Like, why point that out? We're pointing it out because it's going to stand in contrast to other men. He will overcome where other men would fall. He will stay true where other would sin and fail and fall, where others would fall to the wayside, where others would give up. Jesus never did. You know, and it's interesting that in him and his servant relationship on earth, we know that Jesus often went off and prayed. He often went off for solitude. He even asked his servants, pray for me, right? He recognized his need for strength. He recognized his need to trust in God and to do the Father's will. But he never gave up. He was never defeated. He was never weak, not in a spiritual sense. And he kept persevering and giving on. The work of the servant will extend to all peoples. And I think that's what we see through the coastlands. Go ahead, Mark.
You know, verses 1, 3, and 4, this concept of bringing justice and establishing justice. There's a lot of condemnation of Israel in the Old Testament, particularly the leaders, for not dealing justly with, among the poor, you know, irregular weights, you know, and scales are being used or not. But I think there's another aspect of this justice that this servant is bringing. You can read that this is a very humble servant. So, you know, justice, you think justice by the sword, that, you know, a mighty warrior would bring justice. The way I read this justice is at a spiritual level between man and God.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that God can be righteous and also be merciful is if there's a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And so Christ offering himself on the cross allowed God to be righteous, to do justice. The sin was punished.
Mm-hmm.
It just, we weren't the ones who were punished.
Right.
The debt was paid, you know, to use that language. So, in that aspect, he brought justice between God and man,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily on evil nations, but he made possible that God could be just and merciful and mm-hmm. save us at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and we see so many of those contrasts here, and it's interesting that you could have this just powerful section that gave such hope to them and for us gives such clarity to what was done and how that justice was needed and how it was fulfilled. All right, I'm going to put on my Ryan hat and move a little faster because I feel like I'm moving a little slow, but we're on time. We're going to get through this. So as we go into verse 5, thus says the Lord God, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out on the earth and its offspring, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk on it, right? Designed to show Judah that God would not forget them, but it spreads to all the people of the earth, right? And so we kind of see it spreading out on the earth. We saw it in the previous verse saying to those in the coastlands, and it's kind of to those far off. And again, this message is continuing to expand. Verses 6 and 7, I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness, right? Like Mark mentioned. I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you, and I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations, to open the blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and to those who dwell in darkness. Jesus, as a man, needed encouragement. And these verses, it's interesting to look at this verse in particular, these two, from the perspective of Jesus, right? God speaking to the servant, I have called you, I am with you, You will bring salvation to your people and to the nations. And then he gives them this authority on earth to heal and to forgive sins, right? To open the eyes of the blind and to bring the prisoners out of darkness. Right? What is this darkness except this prison that we're in when we are in sin? Right? When Jesus died, he paid that price, like Mark was talking about, you know. And so we look at this. I wonder, these servant songs, what a great encouragement they are to us. What a great encouragement they were to Jesus, right? When he would go, when he would seek encouragement, that he could look to these and know, this is your will, Father. This is the work that you've given me. This was our plan from the beginning, to save those, to save all of the world from this domain of darkness. John 17:18, as you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. Right? He passes it down to us too. Right? That we could open the eyes of the blind, that we could be a light in the darkness, and that we could help show people out of the way of darkness and prison. Verse 8 and 9, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another, nor my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things that have come to pass, now I declare new things. Before they spring forth, I declare them to you. God doesn't exist in a world of other gods. He is God. His identity is his name, and his glory cannot be shared. Right? He can't share it with false gods. And so what does he do? Right? If he left Israel in bondage, then the world would believe him another powerless idol. So he will rescue them for his name's sake, right? He must deliver them to remove this praise and glory that's been given to these graven images. God is a master of the past and the future, holding the present in his hand. And so, right, before these former things pass, I'm going to declare new things, right? What's he saying? These other things, they're false. This glory they have, it's mine. I'm the one worthy of this. And so I'm going to tell you about things that will come to pass so that you will know that I'm God. So as with Cyrus, God can declare new things before they happen, which ultimately is one of the greatest and most powerful testimonies of Jesus, of the servant, right? Is that the servant was foretold centuries before his work was accomplished on earth. 1 Peter 1:19, we have the prophetic word more fully confirmed, to which you will do well to pay attention as to a lamp shining in a dark place, right? We, right? This was Peter speaking a message to the New Testament Christians, to us, right? We have this more fully confirmed, right? These predictions were made that gave them hope. These predictions were confirmed that give us faith. We see it. So we can look, and if we look away into the darkness, right, how much greater is our despair? How much greater are we deserving of the justice that God will bring to those who choose not to follow him? Verses 10 through 12. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing his praise from the end of the earth. You who go down to the sea and all that is in it, you islands and those who dwell on them, let the wilderness and its cities lift up their voices and settlements where Kedar inhabits. Let the inhabitants of Selah sing aloud. Let them shout for joy from the tops of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the coastlands. In the Bible, when God does something amazing, it calls for a new song, right? And we see that in Revelation, right? When they would sing a new song in heaven, right? Jesus was there. He was able to save us, right? He was able to, as it says, worthy are you to take the book and break its seals, for you were slain and purchased for God with your blood, men from every tribe and tongue and people in every nation, right? And they sang a new song in heaven because of that great day, right? Here, this prediction of the servant to come was also worthy of a song, right? It was worthy of a new song, that they would sing praises to the Lord. And it's interesting that in contrast, Cyrus would be one that would come and do the will of the God, but he would provide terror and fear, and people would scream because they were afraid. And yet Jesus provokes song, right? Again, it's a different type of conqueror, right? He will conquer the world and bring justice to the world, but not with a sword. What God will accomplish through his servant is so exciting. And even those in verse 11, most at odds with God, right? We kind of mention these other places, and ultimately these are kind of maybe like the Edomites and some of the surrounding nations, okay? These were people that were at odds with God. These were people that were at odds with the Israelites, with those of Judah constantly. And yet, if they come to him, They will shout for joy from the tops of the mountains, right? Shout for joy to God. These would have been the places that would have been the high places, right? The tops of the mountains were where they would go to worship their idols often. And yet, these people, in contrast, are singing praises to God. So again, we're seeing hope from the Gentiles as well. And in verse 12, since the coastlands, again, those far off, they've been blessed by the servant, so they should praise him as well. And so we're kind of taking it, right? Like Jerusalem, God's people, these surrounding nations, enemies of God, and even those onto the coastlands, even those kind of to the ends of the earth, right? The sea is where it ends. That's land's end. And so we're kind of going even further, and all these people are going to be giving praise to God as well. All right. Verse 13, the Lord will go forth like a warrior. He will arouse his zeal like a man of war. He will utter a shout. Yes, he will raise a war cry. He will prevail against his enemies. Okay, so what we kind of see here is God fighting on behalf of his people, right? But we see some contrasts to the idols that couldn't fight. Even though, right, when we looked around at that time, right, presumably the idols were winning, right? God's people were in subjection. And so maybe some would make a case, but God is telling of a time when he will win his ultimate victory here. The false gods will fall, right? He is going to be the one to lead them to them. Not this king that they wanted in 1 Samuel, right? Give us a king to judge us that we may be like the nations all around. That's what they wanted, but that's what they could never have. God let them have a king, but ultimately God never gave up his sovereignty over his people. He never gave up his promises, right, to let them hang by the noose that they tied, right? They wanted this. They wanted a king, and they did pay some prices for that. But ultimately, God was still going to accomplish that, and he was going to fight for them, right? And Cyrus would be one that would do God's will on God's behalf. In verse 14, it's interesting, we see that it kind of switches to a first person from God, right? This is God showing his perspective. I have kept silent for a long time. I have kept still and restrained myself. Now, like a woman in labor, I will groan. I will both gasp and pant. Long time. Right? Ryan had that as meaning from eternity, which is a very interesting perspective. From eternity, God has been eager to send his servant. And if we look at 1 Peter chapter 1, 1 Peter chapter 1, we see that talked about even to the New Testament Christians. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 20, he was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in the last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Right? He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, right? If we went and grabbed some of our little ones, right? If we went and grabbed Grant Davis, and if you know about the kids' classes, if you threw up that first purple card, right? What would Grant say? He would say, in the beginning, God, what was it? I had it. God had a great plan, okay? God had this great plan before the foundations of the world. Our little ones know that, right? These foundational things that we're teaching them, that is part of it. And that's what's being spoken of right here, right? I have kept silent for a long time. I have restrained myself, right? God was eager to save us. God was eager to send his servant. And what an amazing thing that is. And then ultimately he says, I will lay waste to the mountains and the hills and wither all their vegetation. I will make the rivers into coastlands and dry up the ponds, right? God's removing this sustenance. He's removing these obstacles. But we can't depend on ourselves for those things. But in verse 16, he says, I will lead the blind by a way they do not know. In paths they do not know, I will guide them. I will make darkness into light before them and rugged places into plains. These are the things I will do, and I will not leave them undone. God guides the blind and the helpless. He cures blindness by making the darkness into light. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9. 1 Corinthians 2:9. what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. He removes all obstacles from our path and leads us to his need. They will be turned back and be utterly put to shame who trust in idols, who say to molten images, you are gods. Again, so he kind of sums it up with this contrast, right? And even in light of these great blessings, even in light of God's predictions that we have with us right now, right? Some men will turn back. Some men will refuse to hear. And ultimately, they're going to be utterly put to shame. But there are men who are going to look to the things of this world, to the idols that they create, and say, you are our gods, and we will worship you, even in face of such great evidence. And I'll leave you with John 3 and verse 19. John 3:19. And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. There will always be those who choose the darkness, right? But God is providing a light, and he has given his servant to save us from that darkness. But we have to choose him. We have to make that choice. Any comments? We got a minute or so.
He's telling us the servant is going to do what Israel should have done. They should have been a light to the world. They should have been those that draw others to God, but they weren't.
Yeah.
Jesus does. And even if we fail, Jesus is still going to draw people to him.
Yeah.
And because he's God's servant, and he's the one that's going to ultimately be the Savior. Man's not going to do it.
Yeah.
And they can't.
Right.
And that's what this proves to us.
Yeah, Jerusalem should have been that, but Jesus is going to do that. His servant's going to do that. And we need to be doing that too, but it's going to happen regardless. Absolutely.